should I be interested in this? I just went to a workshop which was basically about tensor networks and holography in Madrid, and I listened to a lot of tensor network talks. And if I were to summarize all of them in one sentence, it would be this. People study tensor networks because they want to understand properties of especially ground states of field theories in ways which are more easily readable than in terms of the usual description in terms of a Lagrangian and perturbation theory and so on. Now, we do have a situation where we have a field theory which has a completely different description, and that description is also local, and that example is holography. I have a CFT on one side, and I have a gravity theory on the other side, and that gravity is supposed to capture lots of properties of the field theory. So it's natural to think it sounds like holography is answering precisely the type of problem that tensor network people are posing for themselves. So maybe holography is secretly a way of doing tensor networks for the specific case of a conformal field theory. So that's kind of the motivation or the high-level picture of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. More specifically, this a relation between tensor networks and holography was posited by, I think, first by Brian Swingle in 2000.
Should the microphone on, please?
Huh? Oh, yes. Turn on the mic. Thank you. Sorry.
Thanks. Yes. More specifically, this connection was, I think, first suggested by Brian Swingle in a paper in 2007. And so let me first review what the ingredients were of that first proposal. So first, Brian matched properties of a specific tensor network, which was the Mera tensor network, with holographic spacetimes, particularly with three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space, which corresponds to the ground state of a 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory. So let's talk about what the ingredients of that proposal were. Mera, first, is a tensor network which consists of the following objects. Each of these elements in this network is a tensor with some indices. The indices are contracted according to this connectivity of the network. And we have two types of networks. We have the isometries, and we have the disentanglers. The job in life of disentanglers first is to remove UV entanglement. And the job in life of isometries is to remove UV degrees of freedom, so that as we go from the bottom to the top of the network, we're essentially going from the ultraviolet to the IR description of the field theory. This is roughly what Mera is supposed to do for us. Now, what do we have in holography? In holography, we're going to look in particular at a spatial slice of a spacetime which is dual to some state in the conformal field theory. So I'll look at a specific spatial slice and draw it over here. And that spatial slice, specifically for the vacuum of ADS3, is just going to be the two-dimensional hyperbolic plane, which I can draw like this for us. And hopefully this is a good rendition of the hyperbolic plane. And for a long time, we have known in some way, or at least suspected, that the radial direction in this spacetime, this is a direction which is totally not present in the CFT, which lives on the boundary. That's the radial direction, which is emergent from the CFT point of view, corresponds to the renormalization group direction in the field theory. So in the interior, I have the infrared, and near the outskirts of this hyperbolic plane, I have the ultraviolet. So it's natural to say, oh, maybe if since the bottom or the boundary of this drawing corresponds to the UV and the middle corresponds to the IR, here I also have a representation where the UV and the IR are separated. This is how I'm representing the state. So this is the first similarity that Brian wanted to exploit in this in his proposal. So I'm going to list some of the guiding principles for why we should be expecting a match. One of them is a representation of RG. The second thing is the symmetries. So if I look at this network, and if I imagine that this network extends infinitely to the future, sorry, to the future, to the top and to the bottom, so I have an infinitely large pattern of this type, then this network is going to be self-similar. Now, the self-similarity is obviously also a property of the hyperbolic plane. And so the self-similarity is another reason why we might expect a match. And the third thing is the way in which entanglement entropies are represented in the network. So under some reasonable assumptions for which the people who specifically work on tensor networks might challenge to some degree, but under some reasonable set of assumptions, when I want to look at a set of, when I want to compute an entanglement entropy of an interval on the boundary, what do I do? First, how do I select an interval? Well, this is the UV and this is the IR. So if I give you a field theory which is defined in the UV, then my intervals are all going to be defined on this bottom line. So for example, this could be an interval given to me in the UV CFT. And what I'm instructed to do to find the entanglement entropy is to look for a minimal cut in this network. In other words, find a way to get from here to there, cutting the smallest number of lines. So that way is just this one over here. Now, what does this, or what is it? Are there any questions about that? What is the counterpart of that on the in holography? Well, in holography, I have Ryu Takayanagi. And Ryu Takayanagi tell me that if this is my boundary CFT, and this is the bulk, the radial direction, if I want to find the entanglement entropy of some region, say this one, then what I have to do is find the minimal surface which is pegged, or whose boundary is pegged at the boundary of my interval on the boundary. So specifically in the case of ADS-free, where I have no time, in the vacuum of ADS-free, where I have no non-trivial time dynamics, so everything is static, all I'm looking for is a geodesic which connects this point to that point. It's supposed to be a codimension 2 minimal surface, but in three dimensions, codimension 2 just means a line, and it's a minimal line, ergo a geodesic. So all we're looking for is a geodesic which connects the one point on the boundary to the other point of the boundary, the two points defining the interval in question for which I'm computing the entanglement entropy. And now Brian said, oh, this picture and this picture, they look very similar. So maybe we should take that similarity seriously. And this is a summary of the relation, which, well, yes, was proposed in 2007. And a lot of people have been taken that to heart and tried to make this more precise or tried to exploit it in various ways. Are there any questions about that set of statements?
If you have graph of the tensor network, is it true that you always have one layer of disentanglers and one layer of isometries?
It depends what we mean by mera. I'm going to, when I say mera here, I will mean a network of this type in the beginning. And then if I have time at the end, I will generalize this somewhat. But this is the typical network that you will see in 99% of papers about mera with this specific structure.
I have a question.
Yes.
Can you emphasize the similarity? I have questions about the coloring. If I think about the mera, and I imagine that all the, so you have these entanglers there. So the mera would be labeled by the dimension of the link, the good space you put on the link. One unitary map.
You mean the dimension, the bound dimension over here?
For instance, that is D is one parameter. Another one would be the parameter for, you know, unitary associated with the box.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one. So there are like three data. So mera comes, this simple mera comes with three additional data.
So
the space time is colorless.
Yes. So the
Is it supposed to be that the space time is the mera?
Yeah. Let me try to make this precise. Mm-hmm. If I were to, so you mentioned three pieces of data that define mera. We could probably split those three into further subclasses. But I would like to look at mera the way I drew this drawing and think of it as really consisting of a mera description of a state as really consisting of two pieces of data. One is the connectivity of the network itself, That was the question I came over, I've got over here. Is that really the connectivity I should be talking about? And the other question is, what do the nodes actually represent? As in, what is the choice of tensors? So if this goes back to the philosophy I started with, I think tensor networks are supposed to be a tool for us to represent states with properties that we desire or we already know in an efficient way. Now, the simplification that comes with tensor networks comes from a clever choice of a network, yes? So I'm going to ask the question, what does this choice of a network tell me about the geometry? Or is it a good choice? Just the choice, the connectivity. Just the choice of the connectivity. And then I will say, so what we will see eventually, let me give a preview of the punchline. What we're going to see is a quantitative way of matching the connectivity of the net or patterns in the connectivity of the network to some objects that describe this spatial slice of the space-time. So just because I'm able to reproduce it from from the connectivity of the network alone, I conclude from that, this is really belongs to the conclusions of my talk, but let me say it right now. I conclude from that that the connectivity of the network defines the background metric or the metric that I have in the space-time, which is dual to my given quantum state, and the various fine choices that I can make at the level of a single tensor are going to correspond to some small perturbations in low energy effective field theory in the bulk around that geometric background. So I'm making a mental separation between geometry and everything else. And what I want to talk about is that geometry. And I posit that the geometry is specifically related to the connectivity of the network alone.
And these unitaries, they correspond to fluctuations of the geometry or fluctuations of matter?
If I get to,
you don't commit to
I don't think that I want to separate between the two. So this is the philosophy. And in general, actually, having said that, let me say one more time. I want to take the connectivity of the network very seriously, because this is a very good ansatz for reproducing ground states of conformal field theories. So if that ansatz works so well, I don't want to say, if something doesn't seem to work at the level of connectivity, there is always, or frequently, my experience is that frequently, people's response whenever I point out something about the network and how it doesn't match geometric properties, people say, oh, but if you choose the tensors in the right way, then maybe you can fix it. I don't want to take that perspective. I want to take the connectivity of the network very seriously, see how much mileage I can get out of the connectivity alone, because it just seems to me very unparsimonious to right from the start say, I'm going to mix the choice of tensors with the network and something will work out. I want to use the smallest possible number of tools, which is the connectivity of the network alone, and get from that as much as possible about the geometry. That's my philosophy. So I will be taking the network very seriously. And other questions?
I don't know. Yeah, just on that line. So there could be other perturbation of your network, which would be defects of the connectivity.
Oh, yes. We will definitely be talking about that. Yeah. Or at least if I have time, I will be talking about that. Okay, so these are the various good things about, or various qualitative reasons why we might believe that this thing is related to this thing. But can we make this representation or this relation quantitative? Before actually answering the answering that question directly, can it be quantitative or not? Let me start by listing with a list of some problems which may worry you to various degrees about this supposed connection between the network and the space-time. So my list of problems over here. The first problem is that Mera is naturally Lorentzian. So I'm going to give these various problems titles so that we can refer to them later. So what do I mean by Mera being Lorentzian? Let me draw a copy of Mera again. This will take me a second, but I will be with you shortly. Vidal and Evenbly in 2003 asked the following question. Let's say that I have done my Mera ansatz. So again, Mera is supposed to be an ansatz, which I then treat variationally to find the description of an actual ground state of the field theory. Let's say that I did this exercise, and I found the choice of tensors, which are contracted in this pattern, which really represents the or minimizes the Hamiltonian in question. And then suppose that I acted with a small perturbation. I want to resolve this problem again, where my Hamiltonian is the same as before, except that I have a small perturbation that acts locally someplace. And the question is, when I have this local Hamiltonian perturbation acting, do I have to solve the problem from the very beginning? Or can I use the solution from the previous problem with the unperturbed Hamiltonian and, well, yes, make some headway out of that? And the answer is that yes. If I do have a, if I have a solution with delta H being equal to zero, and then I turn on this delta H, some of these tensors are going to be unaffected, and some of the tensors will be affected. Which ones are affected and which ones are not? It's simple. I just draw what you would call the causal cone in this network. And this stuff is affected, and this stuff isn't. So this is statement one. Now, this very awfully much looks like the causal structure that we're familiar with from, studying special relativity. When I have a cause acting in some region of space, the region of space-time affected by it is that cone that grows to the future. So it's in this sense that I mean that Mera is Lorentzian. And in fact, even before this paper in 2000, this paper goes by the name minimal updates or something. So these are the minimal updates we have to do for this non-trivial delta H. In fact, the fact that Mera might be thought of as a Lorentzian geometry was already pointed out before by a postdoc at Hanover named Benny. So this is not something that these gentlemen first pointed out, but they gave a rationale for why we might think of Mera as being Lorentzian in a sort of operational fashion. So this is my first little complaint about this connection, because it looks like I do have a causal structure, but that causal structure has no counterpart on the hyperbolic plane of ADS. Remember, here I took the spatial slice, I drew it here, and it was this object that was supposed to correspond to the tensor network. This guy knows nothing about time, it's just purely space-like. So what is this causal structure from the point of view of the hyperbolic plane is my first little complaint about that connection. Are there any questions about that?
What was Ben?
What
was
what?
Ben? Was it Ben, the postdoc who?
Benny.
Benny, okay. Can you comment on what his rationale was?
It was essentially with these lines. So the network always has a... the network seems to favor lines which go at 45 degree angles. I mean, if I didn't draw it like this, but I tried to, how would I say this? All of these lines that I'm drawing, they're either left pointing or right pointing. And so there seems to be a preference for 45 degree angles. And he said, let's take that seriously. Essentially, this was the rationale for that. So yes, the connectivity of this network very naturally suggests some kind of causal structure. Okay, so this is my little problem number one. Oh, wow, that's, I hope I'm not made to pay for this later. Oh, sorry. So rationale number two, or my problem number two, is what I would call the homogeneity of geodesics. And here, I don't have to redraw this. I already have a drawing of this. So this is supposed to be a geodesic, yes? This geodesic is, it's a geodesic on the hyperbolic plane. So as a geodesic in a maximally symmetric space, which hyperbolic plane is, it has no distinguished points. Any one point is just as good as any other. So this point, and this point are just as good from the viewpoint of the field theory. Is there a corresponding statement, or does that expectation that every point on this geodesic is equally good, does it have a counterpart, or is it faithfully represented on the side of the tensor network? And here the answer is a decided no. So here is why. If I take if I draw my tensor network again, and draw the minimal cut in that network, let's say this minimal cut, then you see we're always following these 45 degree lines, which were the lines selected by the Lorentzian structure of the network. And here we're also always drawing the 45 degree lines, and they always meet at a very special point. Now, this might not seem obvious to you ahead of time. You might say, well, every time I'm trying to find this minimal cut, I probably have to do this all over again and really do some combinatorics and see where the minimal cut is. But in fact, the structure of the network is so fixed that without thinking, you right away know where the minimal cuts are. And they always follow these 45-degree lines. Those 45-degree lines always meet at some special point, which is, in my case here, this point. So it seems like on this side, I have a homogeneous geodesic. But on this side, the object that was supposed to correspond to the geodesic is not homogeneous. It looks homogeneous up to here, looks homogeneous up to here, but it has a special point where which is distinguished. Now, you might say, maybe this is an artifact or something, artifact of discretization, or maybe I'm fooling myself in some way. So let's put this to the test. Are there any proposals for how to do the test? Well, OK, so let me make a proposal. What we should be doing is do the same thing that would move this point to that point. Let's try doing the same object, the same operation in the tensor network and see what happens. So what is that operation? Well, how would I ever select a point on a geodesic? Usually, the point on a geodesic is selected in the following way. I have my boundary of the hyperbolic space. I have a geodesic over here. The geodesic is perfectly homogeneous. But so the only way in which I can select a geodesic is with respect to a UV cutoff. So usually in holography, we talk about ADS-CFT, but we always want to regularize our quantities. And basically, what we're doing is selecting a UV cutoff. And it's only with respect to a UV cutoff that we can hope to distinguish one place on the geodesic from another. If we don't have a cutoff, a distance from anywhere to the boundary is infinity, and all infinities are the same. So the only way in which I can distinguish a point over here is to draw a UV cutoff like this. Now, once I have a cutoff, I know exactly where the midpoint is from here to there, and I can select that midpoint as that point over there. Does that make sense? I didn't have to select a midpoint. I could select a point which is 45% of the way from here to there. It doesn't matter. But to make things, to uniquely select a point, I had to make a choice of a cutoff. Are there any questions or doubts about that statement? Yes?
Basically, the problem would have been if you hadn't done that, you're going from infinity to infinity.
That's right.
You can't tell.
Exactly, yes. So what I should be doing is trying to change the cutoff on the Mera side and see if what happens when I change the cutoff. So here is one cutoff. It's just the cutoff at this UV scale. Now, what I would like to do is change the cutoff in some way. So how about if we change the cutoff like this? OK, that's some choice of a cutoff. Now, what I have to do to find the geodesic is to find the minimal line that goes from here to there, yes? What is that minimal cut? It's this one. But you see, my point at the top didn't budge. It's still in the same location. So I performed the same operation that I would have performed in the hyperbolic space. I changed the cutoff. Changing the cutoff from here to here would have moved this point from here to there. But over here, doing the same thing, didn't do anything to this point. It still stays there at the top. Is this problem clear? Questions? Should I move on? OK. Now I have one other problem, but I will probably skip it and go on to problem number, to the next problem after that. And that's strong sub additivity. So one of the things that, are there any doubts about that? OK, so what's strong subadditivity? The tensor network description, or the Mera description, was supposed to be good for me because I had this very nice natural way of encoding entanglement entropies. All I have to do is find that minimal cutoff, sorry, this minimal cut, and count the number of cuts. OK, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in this case. So entanglement entropy is something which is very easily and naturally, yes?
I actually realize I do have a question about that.
Uh-huh.
So you deform the surface up, and then how do you know where the two points on the boundary are that you're trying to connect now that you've deformed the surface? Like when you deformed the surface up, you took it to be the case that the new boundary point is still lying a lot in previous.
Oh, yeah, okay, good. So I did, it's true that I made a choice because maybe what I should have done is gone from here to there, yes? But then my geodesic would have been completely different. It's not that here it would be different. It would be different all over the place. This and this would be very different geodesics. But this, again, doesn't have a counterpart over here. That would correspond to saying, if I just change the cutoff, the geodesic becomes that one. Yes? So I still have a, even if I attempted to do this, I would have a problem likewise. So for strength of additivity. So the point I was trying to pound across is that that MERA is very powerful at representing entanglement entropies. So any object that I write down, or any quantity, which is a combination of entanglement entropies, my expectation is that it should be nicely represented in MERA. And perhaps the most natural thing that we can ask about entropy is the strength of additivity of entanglement entropy. It's just the concavity of the entropy function. Or in other words, it's the law of diminishing returns for information. If I go from one system to a system double the size, I don't need twice as much information to represent it, but a little less. And it's that concavity that strength of additivity tells me about. If I translate this statement into an actual inequality, let's consider three intervals, A, B, and C. The statement is that S of B. Now, S of AB plus S of DC minus S of B minus S of ABC has to be greater than or equal to 0. And that's a statement that ought to be, that has to be true anywhere where I have entanglement. Well, yes, for any good choice of entanglement entropy, for any physical choice. So I have this statement. And now that I have this statement, let's see how it is represented on the MERA side and on the hyperbolic space side. Let's actually start from the hyperbolic space side. So on the plane, let me draw the Poincaré patch of the plane. Here is my region B, here is A, and here is C. And what I'm drawing is, let's take these terms, which come with a positive sign in the inequality, and let's draw them with this color. And then let's take some other color for the negative terms. That's this one and this one. And draw them. And the statement is that the orange minus the blue has to be greater than or equal to 0. That's that statement. But on the MERA side, the situation is, well, similar in spirit, but different in detail. The difference is that if I choose this B and choose C and A, well, remember, our minimal cuts always follow the causal lines, yes? So even without drawing the actual network with triangles and squares, I can right away draw what these geodesics are going to be. And they are this. Here is one of them, the causal cone of the region AB. Here is the other one, the causal cone of the region BC. And then the negative terms are this one and this one. That makes sense? So notice that we have a lot of cancellations. This cancels out, this cancels out, this and this also cancel out. So in the end, what we have is that the number of cuts I make over here minus the number of cuts I make over here has to be greater than or equal to 0. How can that ever be? Well, if I put a disentangler over here, let's do a little science fiction and imagine that there's exactly precisely one tensor that lands there. If I put a disentangler there, then I have 2 minus 2, which is 0, so my strength of additivity is saturated. I don't have a non-zero contribution to this object. The only way that I can have a non-zero contribution is if I have a triangle on an isometry. So what I conclude from this is that strength of additivity, what it's really counting from the MERA point of view, is the number of triangles. Because every triangle takes 2 lines coming from the bottom and spits out one line from the top, so it contributes 1 net unit to this quantity over here. So strength of additivity is the number of triangles. And the statement is that strength of additivity quantity being greater than or equal to 0 is just a statement that the number of triangles is non-negative. OK, that makes sense. Even physically speaking, this makes perfect sense. Because what was the job in life of those triangles, of the isometries? They were supposed to remove UV degrees of freedom, yes? So if I go from a UV description, say, one small system and another small system, And then I put it together to make one system which is large, it's double the original size. I need fewer degrees of freedom, and that's the fewer degrees of freedom, the degree to which this number of degrees of freedom is smaller is exactly the degree to which I have a law of diminishing returns for information. And the way I recover it in the network is by counting the triangles. So triangles remove redundant information from the UV as I go to the IR description. So that's what my strong subadditivity tells me about. OK, so now that we've made this, uncovered this relation between triangles and strong subadditivity, let's go back to what happens on the hyperbolic plane. If I am to take this picture as being a representation of this picture, then I would be forced to conclude the following things. First of all, this one triangle over here, or whatever it is, it may be 5 or 10, but the point is that this set of triangles that live over here correspond to all of this region somehow. Now, I'm bothered by that because this triangle was an IR object. It was, if I take the philosophy of Mera seriously, different layers can correspond to the UV versus the IR separation of the state. So this was a firmly IR object, but it looks like it would have a trace that goes all the way down to the UV. I think that's a problem. There is another problem, which is the presence of this pesky region. It's always there, and what is it? I mean, there's absolutely nothing that corresponds to it on the hyperbolic, on the Mera side. So these are my two big problems about that are related to the representation of strong subadditivity. Are there any questions about that? And finally, probably my favorite problem, which is the most physical perhaps, is the set of allowed UV cutoffs. So I will again, and this is the final time I'm ever doing it, I will have to draw this thing. And I'm really good at it because I've done it so many times. Huh?
Like Tetris.
Yeah, it is. Right. So, remember when we're cutting these, the different. Okay, why did I not draw this this network all the way going all the way down to the bottom? Yes, because I would run out of time and chalk. But also for another reason, because I'm interested only in a state up to some UV scale. So this guy over here is my cutoff. Yes. Now another cutoff I could have chosen. We've already done this here. Was a cutoff of this type. That's not. Spatially uniform, but who cares? It's just some cutoff. Yes, so here's another cutoff. Now, on the hyperbolic space side, so from the viewpoint of ADS, whose spatial slice we're investigating, these cutoffs correspond to various radial scales. So here is one cutoff over here, and another one which I drew like this would be this one. Okay. But now I have a question. I mean, the interior is completely it's completely homogeneous. So any choice of cutoff should be allowed. So why don't I do this thing, which is, it's true, it's exotic, but there is nothing in principle that should forbid me from doing this. Why don't I take a UV cutoff, which is uniform on this side of the plane, but it's very highly coarse-grained on the other side? There should be nothing wrong with that. So this cutoff would be this one. I will get a guy which looks in the bulk, a cutoff which looks in the bulk like it's basically a semicircle. Is that clear what I have done? So I'd like a question. What is the way to represent this on the Mera side? Well, just by symmetry, if going uniformly on one side and on the other side would have been a horizontal line, then by symmetry, there is nothing to tell me how this part of this cutoff should go to the right or to the left. It looks like what I should be doing is something like this, where I go horizontally and then vertically. It's just a symmetry question. Are there any questions about that? OK, so it looks fine from afar. But if we zoom in, we have a problem. Because now my cutoff seems to be doing something like this. And this guy, which was a disentangler, it was a unitary which maps two inputs to two outputs, seems to be treating three independent legs over here as being independent, as in just at the cutoff. And only one of them is dependent on the other three. So this unitary really took two inputs and spat out two outputs. But when I draw this cutoff, I am forced to pretend that I have three independent inputs and only one output. And that's a mismatch. That's a serious mismatch. And so this is my fourth complaint, because I didn't list one of them. And the complaint is that there seems to be a special family of allowed cutoffs, and that special family of allowed cutoffs has no counterpart over here. What are the allowed cutoffs? The allowed ones are space-like. So the problem over here is that according to this Lorentzian structure of the network, we went time-like someplace, and going time-like meant treating some outputs as an input. Are there any questions about that? So in order to not have to erase anything, let me go to that side of the board and tell you how to fix these problems. Oh, but don't we want to keep it here?
You can.
Oh, I can. Oh, I see. Great. Excellent. What do I do?
Oh,
I used the wrong one.
Okay.
Now you have to really plan ahead to give a good talk. Okay, so the idea now is to find a fix. Oh, but I'm actually closer to you, so I like this. So far, we have talked about tensor networks, and we have talked about holography, so it's not difficult to guess what the fix is going to be. And so let's discuss that. What's integral geometry? Very roughly speaking, as a cartoon, the idea is that I have some lengths, and I want to represent lengths as integrals in the spaces of geodesics. That's roughly speaking the idea of that. Now, to do this, I would have to first know what I mean by the measure over the space of geodesics. And secondly, I would have to know over which space of geodesics I am integrating. So here are the rules of integral geometry. If I have a curve, let's say that it's a convex curve for simplicity, then and let me imagine that I have a measure over the space of geodesics, then what I'm going to do is to take the set of geodesics which actually intersect my curve. That's that set. And this is the set over which I will be integrating. It's the intersecting ones. And the ones that don't intersect do not contribute to my integral. So if I can find an expression of this type with a suitably chosen measure, then I will have done a piece of integral geometry. Let's see if it's possible to find a nice measure for this. What kind of properties might we want for this measure? D geodesics equals what? Well, to do this or to think about this, let's not be too geometric. Let's not think about the measure first. Let's just think about some very general properties of what we expect. One thing that we should, so let's make some observations. Here's the hyperbolic plane. And let me draw a geodesic. It's just some geodesic. And over here, what I'm going to do is draw a putative picture of what the space of geodesics would look like. Space of geodesics. Now, if this is a space of geodesics, then this guy simply corresponds to a single point. That's just by fiat, by definition of what I'm constructing over here. So a question I'd like to ask you now is, if I draw another geodesic, how many different, topologically different ways can I draw it? Well, here's what I can do. One choice is to draw a geodesic of this type, which does not intersect my geodesic, and the interval which is subtended by it is a proper subset of the interval subtended by my first fiducial geodesic. A qualitatively different way of doing it is to draw a geodesic of this type, which actually intersects my first geodesic, and now it is no longer true that this interval contains the other one as a proper subset. So we have these at least two qualitatively different ways of representing pairs of geodesics. If so, okay, what does that tell me about this space of geodesics? Well, one thing it tells me is, there are various possibilities. One is that maybe it doesn't tell me anything, but if we assume that this space has a metric structure of its own, this is an assumption, but let's go with it, then that metric structure has to be Lorentzian. Because if I have a metric which is Euclidean, there is no way to represent two qualitatively different ways of for two things to be separated. But in the Lorentzian spacetime, there is. We have time-like separations and space-like separations. So I would like to make an ansatz for understanding the space of geodesics and say that this space is Lorentzian. By the way, does it look like I'm beginning to make contact with the problems listed over there? I hope the answer is yes. So this guy over here, I'm going to mark it over here as a point, and I will say that this is a case which is time-like. And the blue one over there, thank God for colored chalk, is going to be space-like, and I'm going to mark it like this. It's an ansatz, but let's go with it. Now, what is the crossover between the space-like separation and time-like separation? So let's say that I keep the white geodesic fixed, and I take the orange one, and I start deforming it in some way so that it started out as time-like, but it's going to end up in space-like. Where do I do a crossover? Well, as I'm making it larger and larger and larger, it continues to be time-like until this point. And at this point, where it just has a common endpoint, it is infinitesimally separated from being time-like and space-like. So I conclude that the condition for null separation in this space is the condition where two endpoints are shared between the two intervals or the two geodesics. Is that clear? Or does that make sense? So I will make a third one, which is null. And null is precisely this, common endpoint. Common endpoint. But if null separation is decided entirely by having or not having a common endpoint, then let's think about it. It means that I can tell you if two intervals are null separated only by looking at one endpoint and completely forgetting about the other, yes? So if I choose coordinates for my space of geodesics where one endpoint is going to be u and the other one is going to be v, what I just concluded is that each one of these coordinates has to be a null coordinate. Because only by deciding the separation in the v along the v-coordinate, I can tell you that separations are null or not null, yes, regardless of u. So that tells me right away that if there is a structure, a metric structure in this space, in this metric structure, u and v have to be null coordinates, which means that the metric has to take this form. Are there any questions about that? So is everyone in agreement with me? OK, so I will take this. Usually this is a bad sign if there are no questions. But I have a clock running, so I'm just going to say that, pretend that, yes, everyone is in agreement with me. So OK, so u and v, which are the endpoints of this geodesic, are null coordinates themselves. So what I have to do now is to just cleverly choose this conformal factor. What is the choice? Well, it looks like I have choices. But I also have some conditions on this choice. And one condition is that whatever I have to choose, it has to satisfy this equation. If it doesn't satisfy this equation over here, then I haven't done anything. I'm just fantasizing. So here is the choice that works. The choice that works is to, in these u and v coordinates, to choose the conformal metric to be d second s, the conformal factor, du dv, which is it's this second mixed second partial with respect to the two endpoints. Now,
what is S?
Oh, it's the entanglement entropy of the, oh, thank you, great. It's the entanglement entropy of the interval extended between u and v, which is really the length of this geodesic. And I'm taking the length of the geodesic with endpoints u and v, taking the second partial as I'm moving about the endpoints. And this is the object which has to go over here. So why is this a good thing? Well, I just told you this. So we will see this in a second. But let me make some observations about why it's good. So why this choice? The first answer to why this choice is that it is conformally invariant. So we can prove this, that this choice is conformally invariant. If we prove this using a pedestrian methods by actually applying conformal transformations to this metric, then this will take that full board on the other side, and this would be highly unilluminating. But this is a fact. But in fact, we don't have to choose this in a pedestrian, sorry, we don't have to prove this in a pedestrian way. We can just go back to this statement and say, haha, it really is conformally invariant. And why is that? Because lengths are conformally invariant. And so I can think of a set of possible curves which I could plug into this equation as a set of test functions. And if this equation is satisfied for every test function, as in for every choice of curve, then it must be conformally invariant. There's just no way to be otherwise. And so this really is the more elegant proof of why it's conformally invariant. So let's prove it. To prove this, so we're actually going to do the proof. To prove this, I'm going to change coordinates slightly. So far, I've been working with coordinates where this was my one endpoint and this was the other endpoint, okay? But I'm going to choose coordinates in which the middle of that point is called theta, and the end, and the half width is called alpha. Is that okay with everyone? So when I choose these endpoints with these coordinates, the metric becomes this. So alpha came with an extra minus sign, which tells me that this is the time direction. So that's really what we expected looking back at problem one over there. Alpha is where time goes. So over here, in these coordinates, alpha goes up and theta goes in this direction. This is just a choice of coordinates. And now what I have to do is take the volume form, which comes from this metric, plug it into this formula, integrate it over the intersecting geodesics for some curve of interest, and see if I get the length. So let's do that. If I have a curve like this, then at any given theta, let me choose theta, so let's start writing what we have. Length is equal to the integral. First, I have to integrate over theta, because at every angle, I will have some geodesics which will be intersecting this thing. And now, what are my limits of integration in alpha? In alpha, the limits of integration are starting from this guy over here, which is just tangent to the geodesic. That's where my integral starts, because that's where the intersections start. And then they should go on all the way until the other side where I have the other tangent geodesic, yes? But on the other side, these geodesics will be counted from the viewpoint of the other theta, yes? They will be counted at theta plus pi. So it's perfectly OK to integrate just up to the diameter at this point and then continue going around like this. Are you OK with that? So what does that correspond to? The integral d alpha is going to go from the tangent geodesic, which I will go alpha perpendicular of theta, that's this one, up to the geodesic, which is the diameter. But what's the diameter? The diameter is when my alpha is equal to pi over 2, yes? Alpha is pi over 2. So I'm going up to pi over 2. And the thing that I'm integrating is the the square root of the determinant of this metric, which is back again d second s entanglement d alpha squared. Yes? But now it's easy to see what's going to happen, because I can actually do the integral. So I have an alpha over here, and I have an alpha over there, d alpha. So what I have is an integral d theta. And the quantity that I'm integrating d theta is ds entanglement d alpha with an extra minus sign evaluated at pi over 2 and at alpha perpendicular of theta. OK? But what is it at pi over 2? I'm taking ds d alpha, so I'm asking about the change in the entanglement entropy as my alpha varies. And I have to evaluate this here for a diameter. So I'm asking for the change of the length of the geodesic as I'm at the diameter. The diameter is obviously the longest of all the possible geodesics in this conformal frame. So ds d alpha evaluated at the diameter is just 0. So this guy goes away. This minus sign, well, it also comes with the minus sign for the lower term. And so the quantity that I get in the end is just ds entanglement d alpha evaluated at alpha perp of theta. And this quantity, I forgot some factors of 1/2 someplace, but this quantity is exactly equal to the length of the curve, which has been proved by Rob and his collaborators. And it's a formula that I, with my collaborators, first proposed. So this is a known fact that this way can be written or equals the length. So we have satisfied our second condition, really the defining condition of our measure, that lengths really correspond to an integral over the space of geodesics. And this also, by extension, establishes that the choice of measure, and in fact, the choice of this metric, is conformally invariant. Are there any questions about that?
Just about, it's a very nice exposition, but isn't there I mean, it seems to me you're just talking about the usual correspondence duality between planes and points. Like, you know, so I can think of the the sitter as the interior of a conic in projective space. Again, like all the geodesics that are.
Yeah, I am not. Broker, I'm not. I'm not. I'm definitely not pretending to do anything that
so
hasn't
that's,
been.
That's,
yeah, it, this is it. Yes,
so this is. Yeah,
this is it.
This
well,
is
I. Yeah. Well, so. It is. It
this
is.
Formula is kind of interesting.
Yes, it is that, and I think maybe the non-trivial statement. It's not that I discovered it. This has been known since Crafton in the 1870s. But I'm just pointing out the importance of that formula in the context of holography.
But the fact that there's this duality.
Yeah, the fact that there is a duality is a consequence of that. However, it is a consequence of that only for symmetric spaces like
yes.
the sitter and anti-de sitter, and in general it won't be. Okay. Good. So we know that it's conformally invariant. We proved it using the length formula. It computes the length for us. Great. There is another thing that we should mention along the good things about, or in the list of good things about this choice of conformal factor, namely that if I actually plug in the formula for the entanglement entropy of an interval in the vacuum of a two-dimensional conformal field theory, I get this quantity. And then when I take this Sn't and plug it in over here, what I get is a metric which looks like this. There's no minus anymore. Can we recognize this? This is the sitter space, which goes exactly to Laurent's question. So it turns out that this object over here, whose metric we just reconstructed, and it's the space of geodesics, is two-dimensional de sitter. And now, for those of us who are interested in de sitter, this is an exciting fact. For those of us who don't care about de sitter, you might just ignore it, but I think it's pretty interesting because, well, de sitter is interesting. And then there's a fourth thing which I should say. And that fourth thing, the fourth good thing about this choice of metric is really the most important. Oh, sorry, there's one more thing which is not so important. We can ask about points. So what are points on the hyperbolic plane? So what I mean is this. Here is the hyperbolic plane. I have a point over here. And I would like to describe a point as a set of using the set of geodesics which just pass through it. Okay, that's this. So every point, if I take a set of geodesics which pass through it, is going to mark some kind of codimension one object over here. And the question is, what is that object? Is that an interesting question? Kind of. But the answer is interesting. The answer is that points in a hyperbolic space are geodesics in this space. So what we really have is an honest to God duality which goes both ways. Because how did we establish this space? Remember, this point was this geodesic. This point was this geodesic. So geodesics here are points over there. Now what I just told you is the converse, that geodesics here are points over there. So points and geodesics map to one another. And I find that kind of exciting. That's another nice thing about this integral geometry map. But the nicest thing of all, and the one that I really should stress the most, is, let me say it here, because it really should occupy the central part of the board. The fifth good thing about this is that the metric over here, or the conformal frame, so I have this metric here, UdV times the UdV. This guy over here is exactly the quantity that appears in strong subadditivity and has to be positive. So this is the nicest thing that I could possibly imagine from the viewpoint of information theory. First of all, I right away know that this metric is going to be non-degenerate, because this guy is guaranteed to be positive. So great. But moreover, and so how do I mean this, by the way? If I take I wrote strong subadditivity as this statement about A, B, and C. It's this statement. If I take the boundaries of A, B, and C to be U, V, I think I want to put U plus du over here. Sorry, so U and U minus du over here. And here V plus dV. Then this second partial is exactly the continuum limit of this quantity. So it's in this sense that this is strong subadditivity. Does that make sense? So if I take U, A, B, and C to have endpoints given by these coordinate choices, then strong subadditivity is the statement that this partial has to have a definite sign. So it's really nice for me because, first of all, it's so natural from the viewpoint of information theory. But moreover, I can now go over here and say, aha, now I understand why strong subadditivity is the count of geodesics, is the count of triangles. So what we have just learned is that the volumes in this space, this kinematic space, the space of geodesics, volumes here correspond to the, or are given by this quantity over here. This quantity from the Mera point of view is the number of triangles. And so we're really forced to make one specific identification between the two, namely to say that Mera is kinematic space. And volumes in Mera, the numbers of triangles that I have in various regions of this space, really correspond to the numbers of, or the amounts by which strong subadditivity is away from saturation from the viewpoint of the kinematic space. So here is the punchline. Kinematic space, or space of geodesics, is Mera. So over here, I have the space of geodesics. Over here, I have the space of, I have this tensor network, and they are one and the same object. So let's go through our list of problems that I pointed out previously and say why these problems are not problems anymore. Well, first of all, this guy was supposed to be Lorentzian. Do we have that problem? We don't have a problem because the space of geodesics is also Lorentzian. We said that here. So this is a check. The second question, the homogeneity of geodesics. How would I represent a geodesic in hyperbolic space? In the kinematic space. Well, remember, I told you that in kinematic space, so this is my picture of kinematic space, geodesics are just supposed to be points, yes? But we're in a Lorentzian space, so in a Lorentzian space, a point always has its past causal cone. And apparently what this guy is really the past causal cone. This agrees with what I said earlier, that these minimal cuts always go along causal lines. But why should we care about this guy? Why should we care about these null past cones? And the answer is there's a good reason for it. Because what does it represent geometrically in the hyperbolic space? Well, this line is a line of points which are null separated, yes? If they are null separated, then they have a common endpoint, yes? So the set of geodesics which I have drawn over here is this set. So there's a very good reason why we should be thinking about causal cones whenever we talk about points. And that's why this guy ended up being represented over here. But now I don't have a problem with homogeneity, because in kinematic space, I don't expect homogeneity in the representation of geodesics. Geodesics are just points. And it's true that they're canonically associated with their causal cones, but the tip of the cone is not supposed to move about under any symmetry. So I have this problem checked. So 2 is also a check. Strong subadditivity. I tried to say it, but let me say it one more time. Spaces in here, so various, yes. What I do to capture strong subadditivity is just physically count the number of triangles that I have in various regions in Mera. But I have a more or less uniform density of these triangles in Mera. What do I do over here? What I do is for strong subadditivity is, well, I take the strong subadditivity is a volume form. And so again, by just taking the volume, I am counting the amount, or I'm quantifying the amount by which strong subadditivity is unsaturated. So this quantity and this quantity are identical. So the volume here and the volume there exactly agree, which is just what we wanted. So I would say that point 3 is done. At this point, as an aside, yeah?
What about your second subpoint about that other region?
Which one?
In the diagram right there.
Ah, yes, exactly. So remember, geodesics now correspond to these causal cones. So what I have here is 4 geodesics. So I'm going to draw these 4 geodesics. Ta-da, ta-da. but they happen to have causal cones which overlap, just like they overlapped over here, because they have common endpoints. Yeah. All right, great. So point three number is done. Now you might say, hang on, this kind of confuses me, because what I was supposed to do for finding the entanglement entropy is to count the number of minimal cuts over here. Yes? And now what you're telling me is that looking at this equation, which is diagonally away from me, that I should be taking volumes in the space of geodesics. So how is it that the volume integral is supposed to agree with this number of cuts? And that's actually very natural. It's natural because what is the volume over which I have to integrate? It's the set of geodesics which just intersect my geodesic. That's the kind of volume over which I should perform the integral to recover the length. Now, the geodesics that are that intersect my geodesic, according to my rules about intersections in time-like and space-like, are the space-like separated ones, which are the ones that live in this volume over here and in this volume over here. But in those volumes, what I have to count is the number of isometries. And every one of these isometries saturates one of these legs over here. And so by a sort of Gauss's law of EPR pairs, counting isometries here is the same as counting the number of lines that cut. And so I also recovered the previous reason why the cuts were giving a good justification for finding entanglement entropy. And finally, let's talk about the allowed UV cutoffs. And so let's talk about this picture. How would I represent it in kinematic space? Because this is an allowed cutoff. Well, if it's an allowed cutoff, then let me represent it in kinematic space. And how do I do it? I look for a set of geodesics which are just tangent. So that's the set, yes? Now, it looks like they're uniform, so I'm just going to have a sort of straight line. But at this point, I start wanting to follow all of this geodesic at once. So I start getting larger and larger geodesics going up to a geodesic, which is sort of that final one over here. Now, these ones will have approximately, and if we make this corner sharp, then it will be exactly a common endpoint over here on the boundary, which means that, well, yes, they have a common endpoint, and if they have a common endpoint, then they go along a null line, yes? So this set of geodesics over here, going up to this one, is going to be represented by an object of this type. What is this point? It's just this terminal geodesic to which I'm actually have deformed my cutoff surface. But now notice that this space is never going to be time-like. It's always space-like, and at worst, it might be null, but not space-like. And so I recover just my condition on the allowed cutoffs. What would happen if I attempted to have a time-like cutoff like this one of those bad cutoffs? Well, then over here in hyperbolic space, someplace along the way, I would be going from one time-like to another time-like separation, which means that I would have a geodesic like this and a geodesic like that. And their envelope, they wouldn't intersect, so they don't have a well-defined envelope which defines a line which closes. And so that's why time-like cutoffs are not allowed, and we have to have space-like or at best null cutoffs.
So if you have a non-concave.
Oh, yes. So we would also say that non-concave cutoffs are either non-physical or we have to do some more acrobatics to explain what they are.
Is and that a good reason to believe that they're non-physical, apart from the geometry?
Well, the good reason is that let's go backwards. The good reason why we might think that for any region, the entropy should be related to the length of the curve that goes around it is like the Busso bound. But I wouldn't expect that the Busso bound would be valid for a region that goes like this, yes? I mean, so just on the level of totally naive heuristics, I think that when we start making a concave curves or non-convex curves, something should go wrong with the usual relation between entropy and length. And it's not the relation we have proved, it's just the relation we have postulated. So it's natural to make it a
Yeah. I was asking from the point of view of the algae.
So this is more material for a discussion as opposed to me giving a simple answer. But roughly speaking, if I do take a concave curve and represent it over here, then it looks like something like this. And you could imagine that this is a UV cutoff surface, this one over here, that corresponds to the convex closure of this thing. But then over here, I have further some some tensors, which I should pretend that they are independent, or somehow I should add them up or subtract. I don't know, I should treat them separately. And so I could think of this as being a set of independent degrees of freedom, but then I impose some conditions over here. So I would think of concavity as corresponding to imposing some extra conditions on the Hilbert space defined over here. And so the resulting Hilbert space, which would describe the interior of a concave curve, would be something like a coset space where I took the UV thing, the thing corresponding to the convex closure, and then I'm modding out by conditions that I want to impose on the concavity. That's a set of words that we might attempt to say. So I think this is it, but I did want to say one more thing, answering Laurent's question number 0 from the beginning of the talk, which is, am I just talking about that one specific network? Well, since the metric is this, and I know it, then I can just take, let's say that you hand me a state, I can just compute the second partial for every u and v, and out of that I will recover a metric, and then in that metric I'm going to sprinkle triangles or isometries with a density proportional to this object, and the claim that we would like to make is that by doing this, by sprinkling up triangles in a putative network that we're constructing according to this density, I will have constructed a tensor network representation of that same state which you handed me in the first place. And this is what Jamie was telling you about, the procedure to do so 3 weeks ago. So now I offered you a different perspective for why it might work. So this is the end of it, and thank you very much. Sorry I went over.